walk around. I'd love to be mobile. Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
My name is Emily Evans, and it's a delight to be here with you this morning. I thought I'd start with a reading, as instructed. It's from Bell Hooks, who's an incredible author, and this is for feminism, it's for everybody. Imagine living in a world where there is no domination, where females and males are not alike, nor even always equal, but where a vision of mutuality is the ethos shaping our interaction. Imagine living in a world where all can be who we are, a world of peace and possibility. Feminist revolution alone will not create such a world. We need to end racism, class elitism, imperialism. But it will make it possible for us to be fully self-actualized females and males, able to create beloved community, to live together, realizing our dreams of freedom and justice, living the truth that we are all created equal. Come closer. See how feminism can touch and change your life and all our lives. Come closer and know firsthand what feminist movement is all about. Come closer and you will see feminism is for everybody. That's Bell Hooks. So I have to thank you all for inviting me because it's been a minute since I was in a faith community. I grew up as I grew up in Southern Oregon and for years went to the Presbyterian Church with my grandmother, mostly to spend time with her because nobody else in my family wanted to go. So we did a lot of ushering and a lot of lay liturgy together, and those memories of being there with my grandma were really great. And we often did a lot of readings together up at the front of the church, and it was probably some of my first exposure to public speaking, which is now a very daily part of my life. And it feels really lovely to be back in a place of worship again, and thank you all for being so welcoming. I'll come back to my gram later at the end, actually, because I want to tell a story about her. But today, I'm going to talk about the Women's Foundation of Oregon's recent report called Count Her In. Has anybody heard of Count Her In before? Anybody new to folks? Great, see. This will be all new material. So for about 20 years, the state of Oregon, the great state of Oregon, which I firmly believe is the greatest state in the Union, having lived in several states and visited almost all 50, so I can be really declarative about that, we kind of took our eye off the ball. We haven't had a comprehensive report on how women and girls in Oregon were doing in 20 years. To put that in perspective, I was in first grade, sassing my first grade class the last time we had fresh data on how women and girls in Oregon were doing. So that's half the state that we didn't know how they were doing for two decades. And that changed last September when we released this report. Actually, it was a year ago, exactly last week, that we released Count Her In. So today, I thought I'd tell you a little bit about what we found, the good and the bad, and then talk a little bit about what we all can be called together to do to do things a little bit differently, and make sure that what the status quo is not what Oregon will be like for the next 20 years. Okay, so if you remember nothing else about this report, you can remember this single sentence because it sums up the status of women and girls in Oregon right now. Oregon women and girls are giving more, but getting less than women and girls in most other states. Giving more, but getting less. Put a different way, Oregon women and girls are contributing an incredible amount to our state, to our communities, and in turn, they're facing some of the starkest gender inequities in the country. So let's start with the good news. Let's start with the contributions. Part of this report, we compiled a bunch of data with researchers and a bunch of experts, but we also went on the road. We hitched up my grandparents' 1985 Southwind RV, which had really lousy suspension. And we drove it all over the state, 3,000 miles. We made 14 stops all over. We went to the coast and to Bend and to Pendleton and the Umatilla Reservation, Burns, Ontario, Southern Oregon, all over. And we heard from 1,000 women and girls. So we saw things not only in the data, but we heard things in communities about what it's like to live as a woman girl in Oregon right now. And we heard stories of incredible contributions. So some of them, this is just the tip of the iceberg of the ways that women and girls in Oregon are making our state a great place to live. 2 million women and girls in Oregon. They vote at higher rates than Oregon men and at higher rates than women in most other states. Caregiving. Oregon women and girls perform nearly 1.5 billion hours of unpaid caregiving each year for children, relatives, neighbors, and friends. 1.5 billion hours each year. I don't know that we should necessarily celebrate the unpaid part, but we'll leave that aside. Very minimal violent crime. Fewer than 5% of the violent crimes in Oregon are committed by women and girls. This is a favorite. Physical activity. Oregon women and girls are the most physically active in the country. Engage in more daily physical. I know. And you know what? I think Colorado thinks it's number one. Doesn't it seem like they would think they were number one? I mean, I love Colorado, but I just think that they probably think that. So I encourage you all to just share that fact with anybody from Colorado. other contributions. Education and healthcare. Women make up 70% of Oregon's public school teachers and over 80% of the state's healthcare workers. When you were talking about education and healthcare in this state, you were talking about women. Generosity with money and time. Oregon women give charitably and volunteer their time at higher rates than both Oregon men and than women in most other states. Public service. Oregon women serve in statewide elected office at some of the highest rates in the country, and Oregon women also serve in the U.S. military at higher rates than women in most other states. And finally, educational attainment. Oregon girls met the state's 2025 goal for college graduation rates in 2014, 11 years ahead of schedule. Timing. Yeah, right? Okay. So that's, we call those things the eight to celebrate, because who doesn't love a rhyme? Those are eight ways that women and girls in this state are making our state a wonderful place to be. So there's a huge amount to celebrate, and these contributions are really extraordinary, and we saw them in every community we went to. All right, everybody take a deep breath. We're now going to go into what we call the eight that can't wait. This is the bad news. These eight are the things that rose to the top in the data, in the communities, and among experts as the eight most pressing issues facing women and girls in Oregon. And I'll go through them with you now. The first is violence against women. An estimated 1 million women and girls in Oregon, over half the state's female population, has experienced some form of sexual or domestic violence. It's one of the highest rates in the country. And that, let me put that in perspective. Last year alone, 10,000 calls for shelter from domestically violent situations went unanswered because of a lack of resources. 10,000 calls, that's about the size of the city of Pendleton. So in effect, our state is just saying, good luck, city of Pendleton. Hope that works out for you. It's pretty alarming. Our communities are not equipped to handle that volume of survivors. Over half. This is not a small, marginal number. The next is systemic racism. Women and girls of color in Oregon experience disproportionate barriers to success, and we see that all over the data, whether it be poverty, lack of access to educational opportunities, violence, lack of access to leadership opportunities. The women who are living at the intersection of racism and sexism face extraordinary barriers. And they also continue to contribute at some of the highest rates despite those additional barriers. One of the most frustrating things about this report, actually, was the way in which the data itself made it difficult to look at the lives of women of color. In most of the big data sets, even the big federal ones, you cannot disaggregate by both gender and race at the same time. It's as if the data itself is resisting understanding people as whole people, and it's making invisible 500,000 women and girls of color who live in Oregon. We can't have insight into their life because we can't know what it's like to be both a woman and a person of color at the same time. Get off my soapbox about that. The next, we're only three in, is the cost of caregiving. Oregon has some of the least affordable child care in the country. It costs more to send your toddler to child care for a year than it costs to send your freshman in college to U of O for a year. And it is hitting women and families at entirely different point in their life cycle. You know, we help people save for college for 18 years, and we sure don't help them save for, you know, toddlerhood. And what we see is that it's all the way around damaging, mostly to women and girls, because who is working at care facilities? Mostly women, and they're making mostly minimum wage. So we see the whole ecosystem of care and caregiving and the way we value it is broken. And it's particularly bad here in Oregon, where we're in the top three least affordable places for child care in the country. Next is one that is bad news, but it's a little bit of good news because we saw some really great progress on it in this last legislative session. Gaps in reproductive health access. This isn't a great indicator, but hundreds of thousands of women and girls in Oregon lack access to the reproductive information and services they need to determine when and if to have a family. And we see that in the data because almost half of the pregnancies in Oregon each year are unintended. It's not a great metric. There's some other obviously messy parts about it, but it does let us know, and that number is basically unchanged over the last 20 years. So it does let us know that systemically, we have a lack of full access to information and services that women need to determine their own reproductive futures. And we heard that all over, like down in Lake County, which is out down by Plymouth Falls, there was a nurse practitioner who by the second Tuesday of the month had run through all of her available funds for folks that were coming in to seek contraception, state funds. Second Tuesday of the month. We saw some great progress in the legislative session with the Reproductive Health Equity Act last session, and we should be able to fill some of those gaps, and my hope is the next time we do this report, we will start to see that unintended pregnancy rate going down. Okay, we're halfway through. Stretch a little bit. Everybody just gets lower and lower in their seats as we go. Okay, so next we're talking about the wage and wealth gap. So Oregon women earn between 53 cents on the dollar and 83 cents on the dollar compared to Oregon men, and depending on what race and ethnicity we're talking about. It's really unfair to boil it down to a single number, because 53 cents on the dollar for Latina women is a whole different story than 83 cents on the dollar for white women. And as far as how Oregon compares to the rest of the country, we're about middle of the road on the wage gap. I always feel like, yay, we're middling. That's, that's not good to me. But if you consider what we call the wealth gap, which is the sum of a person's assets compared, not just income, we are the second worst in the country. We have the second highest wealth gap in the country. Oregon women hold about 35 cents in wealth compared to every dollar held by Oregon men. It's a shocking difference. And we also know that wealth is actually where economic resilience and stability comes from. Things like a rainy day fund, or some equity in your home, or a retirement fund. That's what helps families weather turbulence, economic turbulence. Often it doesn't come from income, it comes from wealth. So when you're looking at a gap that size, you're talking about economic instability for hundreds of thousands of Oregon families, mostly led by women. Next, that leads us to what we call economic fragility, which is really just another word for poverty. But we wanted to capture the sense of living on the edge, that sort of precarity, because over a third of the families in Oregon, most of them headed by women, cannot withstand an unexpected expense of even $100 without having to sell something or borrow money. Has anybody picked up a nail in their tire lately or gone to an emergency trip to the dentist? $100 goes real quick in ways that happen to all of us that are nobody's fault. It just happens. And we have a third of Oregon families experiencing that economic precarity that we call being economically fragile. Most of them are headed by women. And that's not what we want. On the southern tier of states, along the California border, 40% of families fall into that category. We heard pretty routinely when we were in Southern Oregon, a woman who had to choose between prescription medication for her daughter that was necessary for her daughter to continue to live, rent, and gas in her car so she could go to work. There was no way for her to pay all those three expenses every single month. So every single month, something had to give. And we know that thousands of families are in that same boat. The next to last one are mental health challenges. This was the most surprising to me, because we saw it in the data, which I'll tell you in a moment, but it came out in communities when we spoke to people. Every single place we went, it was among the top three things that the community identified as a pressing issue. And I wasn't so sure how willing people would be to talk about it, but damned if they aren't right, because Oregon has the single highest incidence of depression for women in the country. And people are like, it's because it rains. And I'm like, have you been to Washington State? You know, or like Norway, one of those countries where it's like cold and cloudy all the time, but everybody's happy and 1,000 flowers are blooming. It's not the weather. we also have the single highest incidence of heavy drinking, high amounts of opioid use, and Oregon women attempt suicide at twice the rate that Oregon men do. And we have much higher than average adverse childhood experiences or childhood trauma than other states that are comparable. So mental health challenges, again, one of those three top issues that was consistently identified every community we went to. And Oregon women and girls know exactly what's wrong because that's what the data say too. And the last one is what we call the public-private glass ceiling. This has to do with leadership. There, at the time of this report, was only one woman CEO of a publicly traded company in Oregon. Does anybody know who it was?
Well,
Tamara Lundgren, what was that?
Columbia.
Yeah, but yeah, you know, Gert was, but now she's technically now the president and not the CEO. We did have four, and then a bunch of people retired, and then now it's just Tamara Lundgren at Schnitzer Steel. But 2 months ago, PG&E announced that they have a new leader who is a woman, so now it's a two, which is great. But it doesn't seem like we should send them like a care package or something, like, you know, like some chocolates. I also love, especially with Schnitzer Steel, that it's like a steel, you know, like they make steel for railroads, you know, like it's, you know, it's not like, I mean, it would be fine if it was a clothing company or something, you know, but like it's really like they make steel. I really like that part. So we only have one, now two, woman CEOs of publicly traded companies. But the public sectors know better. We have a woman governor, which is extraordinary, but we still only have about 30% of the state legislature that are women.
Kaiser also has a woman CEO.
Yeah, yeah, awesome.
What did you say?
Kaiser has a woman CEO. We also know that several counties in Oregon don't have a single woman serving in countywide elected office. Not one, which is particularly damaging when you think about how many decisions are made at the county level with respect to resources for women and families. So, those are the eight that can't wait. Violence against women, systemic racism, cost of caregiving, gaps of reproductive health access, the wage and wealth gap, economic fragility, mental health challenges, and the public-private glass ceiling. And the moral of the story there is that Oregon has a big problem with gender equity. And it's incumbent upon all of us, as Bell Hooks says, feminism is for everybody, and it's incumbent upon all of us to do something about it. So I would like to chat a minute about things that every Oregonian can do to make things a little bit better. I think one of the things that can be daunting when you hear a list like that, and you hear the data, and you understand that we are not talking about small numbers, in many cases we're talking about 500,000 or a million women and girls or families, is that we think it's just too big. We couldn't possibly start to tackle that together. It's too big of a problem. It's not something that we could actualize every single day. But actually, I don't think that's true. I think that we know how to solve some of these problems, and we know how to solve them at a personal level, and we know how to solve them at a community level, and we know how to solve them at a systemic, statewide policy level. And in these times, in 2017, I don't think anybody will disagree that these are challenging times for our country, challenging times for our state and world, and that it's incumbent upon all of us to take the actions every day that we are capable of in order to interrupt these inequities and to disrupt systems of oppression and power. So, five things every Oregonian can do. Number one, ask. In a bunch of communities, these issues haven't been talked about for a long time, or they're not consistently being talked about. Like, for instance, does anybody have high schoolers, middle schoolers, high schoolers? Yeah. Okay. If your daughters play sports, I bet you that your daughter's games are before the boys' team's games. They play basketball or volleyball or soccer or whatever. Often, they're at 3 and the boys' games are at 5 or whatever. I bet that they also have a cruddier bus than the boys' teams. And often that means that they have fewer fans at their game, and they have to get out of school earlier, so they miss more class. And these are just the sort of things that just happen in the world that we don't ask about. We aren't going to our athletic directors being like, hey, what's with that? Why are the girls' cross-country meets always ahead, you know, 2 hours before the boys' cross-country meet? Or, for instance, why not ask about why there are not as many women in leadership at your place of work, if you're able to ask about that? Why not ask about why there isn't pay transparency in terms of who's making what at what levels, which is something that we know is disproportionately affects women and people of color. So not necessarily being confrontational, not being demanding, just asking the questions so that people start to think of things in systemic ways about how we might be disadvantaging women and girls as opposed to men and boys. And it's not about being anti-man, it's just about understanding the ways that we've set up the system to be inherently unequal, because we know what outcomes are coming. We know what we get when we keep doing that. The next thing that every Oregonian can do is to vote. We know that Oregon women are voting at high rates, huh? So Oregon fellas vote at high rates, and when you vote, think about the ways that your elected officials might approach these issues related to sexism, racism, classism, anti-immigration. These decisions, made even at the local level, are incredibly important. And the more we vote people in who reflect both who we want to see in leadership and who reflect our values, the better outcomes we're going to get. Next is to donate. I know this is an incredibly generous community. There are organizations serving women and girls in every community in this state, and typically they get about 4 cents on the dollar in terms of funding for the entire nonprofit sector. They are often chronically underfunded, often because they're serving communities that are increasingly marginalized in more than one way. So when you donate, think about ways to give to programs or organizations that are serving women and girls. The next is to share this kind of information. Share CounterIn. You can go to counterin.org and download the whole report. You can download the executive summary. You can go to our Facebook page and share some of the stats that we've chatted about today. The more we start to talk about this, the more it becomes part of our collective consciousness of what we need to solve together. I bet most of the folks know in this room that Oregon has really dismal high school graduation rates. Yeah? We're like among the, I'm seeing a lot of heads nodding, among the worst in the country for graduation rates. That's something, until about a decade ago, with the work of Stanford Children and the Chalkboard Project and others, that we didn't necessarily know. That wasn't a part of our awareness of who we are. And we had less urgency to solve it, because without full measure of the problem, it's difficult to get up the impetus to solve it. So the more people can start to talk about these inequities, and we come to understand how painful they are for us as a state, the more we'll be able to make progress. And the final thing that every Oregonian can do is to recognize that the women and girls are making exceptional contributions and to celebrate those contributions and to thank them for them because they go under-recognized, I think, often. And the more we can call them out, the assets as well as the deficits, the better off I think we'll all be. So a little bit about CounterIn. As I said, you can go and download it. I have copies with me if you want to grab one. I have copies of the executive summary if you want to grab that. We are actually producing a calendar at the end of the year at the Women's Foundation called Gender Equity Every Week, where things like that, specific things, actions we can take every single week for 52 weeks will be on it, so that we can all feel like there's something that we can hold on to. And the Women's Foundation itself is all member supported. It's kind of funny. When I think about the report, it used to be funded by the state, and then, you know, lean times at the state meant that we didn't have the report, which is why it wasn't produced in 20 years. So the Women's Foundation is a public foundation, which means that people come together and contribute, and all of our operating funds for our grant making and efforts like the report are all collectively funded. So it's like women in Oregon had to come together to fund their own report to let people know how bad things were. But that's how women in Oregon do. They're just gonna take matters into their own hands. And I would so love to talk to everybody about the report and about any thoughts you might have and about ways to get engaged with the foundation, because we would love to have you all with us. I'm so grateful for your work as a community and as individuals. I want to end with a story about my gram, who I used to go to church with. So my gram was like 5 foot nothing and like little curly hair and like really fierce, right? Like a general badass. She was she got a master's degree in the 40s when that was really rare. She had, you know, navigated work-life balance before that was really a thing. She was the dean of women and then the dean of students at SOU, and just generally a badass despite being very small. So we were real close, and there was one time at Bryn Mawr, I went off to college, and we were headed to the mall in Washington, D.C. to do a big protest about reproductive rights. And I was feeling great about myself, and I had my sign, and I was practicing my chants, and I was really feeling like a feminist. And so I did what I normally did when I felt like I was really a badass feminist. I called my gram, and I was like, "Hey, gram, I'm gonna go down to D.C. and do this thing. It's gonna be so great." And she was like, kind of a little bit sad on the phone. And I was like, "What's up? You're like normally my biggest champion. Like, you know, I thought you'd be so happy that I'm going to do this thing." And she goes, "Oh, I am happy and I'm proud of you. I just thought that by the time I was a grandmother, the fight would be over." And she said, "But it's not. So you're just going to have to keep fighting the good fight until it is. And that's why I do what I do. That's why I'm a member of the Women's Foundation. And that's why I would love for you all to join us in our work to create a great place for women and girls here in Oregon." thank you all so much. And I would love to chat with you after the service is concluded. Thanks so much.